Well, here we are.
It is time, Simba.
If you understand that reference, you might be about the age where we should be working together. It's possible. But it is now one of 3 times a year that I'm accepting clients for my freedom framework, overcoming food sensitivities and increasing energy without unnecessary restriction. My goal for my one-on-one clients is to take them through frameworks and explore tools for achieving 50, 80, 90% of their goals in just a few months and show them how to continue to heal on their own so they don't need me anymore. Honestly, I think we're doing great one-on-one work here, helping women that would otherwise be falling through the cracks, thinking that they're just aging, that they're just moms, that they just, and it may be true that they just have stress, when really those stress hormones and their other core systems just really need some serious support and some serious love to serve them for years to come without symptoms. So if you'd like to clear inflammation, eczema, food sensitivities, or improve energy and brain clarity, I'd love to chat with you. You can book a call with me at kristabigler.com/FSS, kristabigler.com/FSS, and that link will be in the show notes.
Fix that, because failure to fix sleep apnea will take 10 years off your life. Increased risk for hypertension, increased risk for diabetes, increased risk for depression, increased risk for obesity. So sleep apnea is low-hanging fruit that we want to make sure we fix.
Stress is the inflammation that robs us of life, energy, and happiness. Our typical solutions for gut health and hormone balance have let a lot of us down. We're over-medicated and underserved. At The Less Stressed Life, we're a community of health-savvy women exploring solutions outside of our traditional Western medicine toolbox and training to raise the bar and change our stories. Each week, our hope is that you leave our sessions inspired to learn, grow, and share these stories to raise the bar in your life and home. Today on The Less Stressed Life, I have Dr. Gary Kaplan, who's a clinical associate professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine, founder and medical director of the Kaplan Center for Integrative Medicine, and the author of Why You Are Still Sick, How Infections Can Break Your Immune System and How You Can Recover, which I love that title, by the way. A pioneer and leader in the field of integrative medicine, Dr. Kaplan is one of only 19 physicians in the country to be board certified in both family medicine and pain medicine, being so important, which we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kaplan.
Krista, thank you for having me on the show, and I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and we were just discussing offline about all the things we're going to talk about. It's going to be so much fun. First, story time. Love to hear about your story. And now you're a DO. Our yes. Stereotypes of DOs is that maybe, I don't know if this is a correct stereotype, this is just a stereotype I grew up with. DOs are more open-minded to different things. And I know the things that you treat, and these are things that not everyone recognizes as even problems. So tell me a little bit about the background and how you ended up in integrative medicine.
So, well, DO is basically the difference between the DO and the MD is we're better looking. Unfortunately, the osteopathic profession had the opportunity to evolve into the premier integrative preventive medicine field and did not do so. Their motto, unfortunately, was we're as good as you are. And what happens when you have that as your mantra, you end up becoming them. Them being the allopathic profession. So we lost a lot of potential as a result of that. Only about 20% of osteopaths do any manual therapy as part of their practice, though it's part of all of our training. And it's a shame because manual therapy is an extremely important tool. I'll tell you, a lot of my, you know, the naturopaths pretty much took over that the position in terms of properly integrating the integrative medicine with conventional medicine. And they've done a beautiful job in terms of doing that piece of things. But my training is informed certainly by my osteopathic background, by my allopathic background, because I'm dual trained. I'm boarded in, my boards are all allopathic boards. My residency training was an allopathic training at Georgetown. But I'm also trained as an acupuncturist. I trained at UCLA, the acupuncture training program for physicians, and I've taught in that program. And I was one of the physicians who helped integrate acupuncture into mainstream medicine through the consensus process at NIH. So I've served on a couple of consensus committees at NIH. I have served as an advisor at NIH, and I've served as an advisor at Health and Human Services for specifically chronic fatigue syndrome. And so I come from a real varied background, but I'll tell you, acupuncture had one of the strongest influences on me because acupuncture is about root causes, and allopathic medicine tends to be about symptoms. So as we started to look into this, I'm a pain specialist, I'm a family medicine specialist, And back in the 90s, the American Academy of Pain Medicine thought it would be a spiffy idea to start treating chronic pain issues with opioids. And it turned out to be somewhat of a profoundly bad idea, and we're reaping the consequences of that. But what happened for myself was I started treating patients in that manner and found that they were pivoting between depression and pain. And I got very curious as to what that was about. And so I pulled together a bunch of colleagues from NIH and from Georgetown and said, okay, guys, let's meet once a month, talk about this and explain this to me, because there was no making any sense to this. This was back in the mid, late 2000s. So we started that. And what we found as we were working on this was what became the neuroinflammatory model of chronic pain and depression. And I wrote my first book about that called Total Recovery, where we looked at inflammation from the standpoint of the cause of pain and the cause of depression. And that was just at the beginnings of thinking about that. And that has proven multifold over to be correct.
I lit up so much when you said this, because everyone with fibromyalgia has depression. And I'm like, why? Why does everyone with fibromyalgia also have depression? So you were way ahead of me on that. Thank you.
So what they had, well, thank you. It was a lot of work with some very smart people. But what we found and what we were looking at is, so the immune system's two great big places, mm-hmm. All right? On one side is the innate immune system. Those are our first responders. Those are the white cells that everybody knows about. In the brain, it's a particular cell called the microglia. And a lot of my research and work was on microglia. Mm-hmm. And so if you can help modulate the microglia, then that helps to slow down the inflammatory process. You don't want to turn it off, because you don't want inflammation we need for healing, but too much inflammation can kill us. So you always have to figure out what is driving the inflammatory process. And in this case, we're first looking at microglia, and easy way to treat the microglia was by modulating with a medication called low dose naltrexone. Naltrexone in high doses is used for treating opioid overdoses. But at very low doses, it actually quiets the hyperactivity of the microglia, which can help with sleep and depression and chronic pain issues. So little tiny dose, 4.5 milligrams once a day, period. You don't want to go higher than that, because then you're getting into full pharmaceutical doses of it. But you can also use CBD to quiet down the microglia as well, because there's a CBD receptor on the microglia. Mm-hmm. So the CBD can be another thing. THC can be other things that help down-regulate the microglia, which is why, in fact, we're seeing that CBD and THC, marijuana, has been, in fact, helpful in certain ratios to modulate pain.
I love this.
So
can I ask you a question about the CBD?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. When I initially learned, when I was originally wanting to bring CBD into practice, it was still a little taboo as far as who could get it, who couldn't get it. But what I learned at that time is what I'm still applying if I'm using it now, which is start at maybe 15, 30 milligrams, and then go up by 15 milligrams until you find the dose that's actually giving you some efficacy, because you've got to fill these cannabinoid receptors, and I can't tell you the exact dose. So just kind of titrate up to see what you need. Would you change that?
Nope.
All right, cool.
Nope. I do lean more toward the away from CBD, because I find that it's not quite as effective. I need a little bit of THC mixed in there.
How's that working for taboo issues with these?
We're legally licensed to, dispensaries in Virginia for marijuana, same in DC and same in Maryland. So it's not been an issue. So there's a lot of states that now license it and thus give us access to it. The challenge is which product to give. And there's no friggin' standardization across. And you can have 200 different products. And so generally I turn to the pharmacist who's managing the formularies and go, okay, what makes sense for this person? Because what's available in Virginia is different than what's available in Maryland, is different than what's available in D.C. These products do work, but you do have to play a little bit in terms of figuring out. And you're not getting high on these products, by the way. What you're doing is it's helping with sleep, it's helping with pain, it's helping with depression.
Yeah, so, I love this. Okay, I want to overarch what you're saying, because I want to make sure it sinks in. Because so often here, and even this morning, I had a different but comparable conversation about very different things. And we were talking about immune system buckets and what contributes to it. So I'm excited we're talking about it from a different way. So immune system, two big buckets. There's the innate immune system. I feel like a lot of that lives in the gut. And you can correct me. And in the brain, it's microglia. And so the microglia for sure are driving inflammatory responses in these big chronic pain things with mood stuff. And so you are using either LDN or CBD and or THC to calm microglia? And are there any other strategies for down regulating or tamping down microglial activation that you want to make sure we cover.
So the simple things, exercise. Exercise is a lovely anti-inflammatory in the central nervous system. So exercise is very important. How much? At least 3 to 4 times a week, but you don't have to be running. You don't have to be jogging. You may do it with just walking, but anything that gets your heart rate up and gets your steps in can be highly effective. Now, for people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, not so easy. Everything has to be about pacing, not pushing. So we have to be respectful of where the given individual is and what they can tolerate and what they can't tolerate. But the biggest thing, sleep. Got to fix your sleep. And a lot of these people are not sleeping or are getting really screwed up sleep. And the thing about sleep is it's not a thing. It's not on off. It's a whole bunch of stages. So in stages 2, 3, 4 in REM, 3, 4, we actually group together and now call slow wave sleep. REM is classically associated with dream sleep, but, and it runs through about a 90-minute cycle. So we want to make sure that your sleep's not highly fractured during the night. I have people whose brains are so inflamed that they'll sleep 4 or 5 hours every 3 to 4 days, whether or not they need to. So we have to do a lot of work to quiet and think of it as being inflammation in the central nervous system. That's the reason that you're not sleeping. Okay. And so what do we need to do in order to manage that? But sleep is something that's crucial. About 5% of people struggle with a thing called sleep apnea. 85% of those people don't know they have it. The symptoms are snoring. You're never rested when you wake up in the morning. You may fall asleep during the day. There is a very simple test you can take called the Epworth, E-P-W-O-R-T-H. Look it up online, Google it. It'll take you 2 minutes to answer the questions. If you score 9 or above on that test, you need to talk to your doctor about possibly having sleep apnea.
Why is sleep apnea out of control? I mean, I feel like it's extremely common.
Well, 5% of the population would rate it as very common. I think obesity is certainly one factor that contributes to it. Lack of exercise contributes to it because we get relaxity of the muscles in our throat and that collapses. Medications can certainly contribute to it. So there's a lot of medications, opioids in particular, that can cause sleep apnea, what causes central apnea as opposed to obstructive. So, and there are some antidepressant meds can do the same thing. So it's a combination of things, but we're also better at diagnosing it. So it was sitting there, we were just missing it.
I just wanted to pause on that because I am intrigued by breath work. Oxygen, breathing dysfunction, huge problem, right? And I've got a breathwork colleague who says he works on sleep apnea and improves it. And it would make sense that they improve airway function, maybe muscle function, et cetera, of that area and potentially improve it, I'm guessing. So just think about how to make
things better. All of that stuff can be highly effective. Dental appliances can be effective that pull the jaw out and take the tongue off the back of the throat. But honestly, the thing that's most effective is CPAP. But you really have to demonstrate that you fix the apnea and you do that with a sleep study. We can now do that at home. There's a little device called a WatchPad that you have to get by prescription, but you can measure at home and it's a disposable device and it's FDA approved.
That's great.
It does a beautiful job of determining whether or not you have sleep apnea. If that's there, man, first, second, and third, fix that because failure to fix sleep apnea will take 10 years off your life. Increased risk for hypertension, increased risk for diabetes, increased risk for depression, increased risk for obesity. So sleep apnea is low-hanging fruit that we want to make sure we fix.
And if you're struggling, change your mask maybe. Like talk to your provider about, like if you're still waking up.
You've got to work and make sure that even though you're on sleep apnea, you need to make sure you fixed it, right? Yeah. So, and it takes a while to work with this stuff. And you got to work closely with your practitioner to get the support you deserve. The other thing that you started to bring up was the gut. And the gut's an interesting challenge. For one thing, low-dose naltrexone has been used for and highly effective for ulcerative colitis and for Crohn's disease. So it's one of the things that can help modulate and improve the functioning of the gut. But, you know, the gut and the brain chat, you know this well, and basically unhealthy gut, unhealthy brain, unhealthy gut. Now, that's a big challenge, though, because we want to do everything we can to heal the gut, and there's a lot involved in potentially doing that. You start off with the basics, all right? I'll have all of my patients start on what's called a hypoallergenic diet around here. Rice, fish, chicken, fresh fruits, vegetables, end discussion. That's what you're eating. You do that for a month. The challenges I have in the first week, everybody's complaining to me about, well, what do I eat? We work with them on that. And then the last week, they're complaining to me, well, I'm better, now what? So we have to pay attention that food is medicine. And we need to be attentive to what's appropriate for ourselves, which is different from individual to individual. I will tell you, celiac disease is about 1% of the population. the average age of diagnosis of celiac disease. So this is an autoimmune reaction to gluten, okay? Bread products, wheat. So the average age of diagnosis now is between ages 40 and 60. We used to think that this was a disease you either saw in childhood or didn't, and it wasn't there. The reality of the matter is we're now seeing it much later. Why? I believe it's epigenetics, meaning that environmental factors are challenging our immune system, and then something trips off the expression of that gene. Because 35% of the population said genetic risk for developing celiac disease, but only 3% of them will ever have celiac disease. So the overwhelming majority of people don't get celiac, even though they get the genes tendency toward. And the thing about genes is they're not our destiny. Genes are a suggestion of what might be. Some cases they'll express more firmly than others, such as eye color. But in other cases, it really is about what the interaction between us and the environment. Toxins and what the foods we're eating, whether you're in specific poisons, and things like child abuse can have a very significant impact on our long-term health. If you look at adverse events of childhood, which is the clinical name for child abuse, child neglect, we see in these individuals a 15% increased risk over the population of developing autoimmune disease, a 25% increased risk of developing heart disease, a 25% increased risk of developing diabetes. Psychological stressors have very severe long-term impacts on us, and we need to be attentive to those as part of a whole healing process of what we're doing. Stepping back to the gut, if the gut's leaky, the blood-brain barrier around the brain is going to be leaky, which keeps things out. And so we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to get good healing on the gut. There's a number of tests that we do, but there's that gut's a whole big topic. We do a whole show, and you probably have, on just gut microbiome and the health of that.
Yeah, right.
But an extremely important part of what we're doing. Now, there's an interesting thing. We have documented changes in the gut microbiome with a whole array of different diseases, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, but diabetes. All of these are inflammatory diseases, by the way. But what we've found is that there's not a fingerprint pattern, meaning a specific set of bacteria that say, this correlates. You do this, you get Parkinson's, you do this, you get Alzheimer's, whatever. So that doesn't happen. What we see is a tendency to what's called an inflammatory gut microbiome. And the consistency is an imbalance of Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes in the gut, which are specific bacterial families. If you were to sterilize the gut and put in a new gut microbiome by doing a fecal transplant, it'll hold for about a week, maybe a month, and then everything reverts back. Because if the primary process is not in the gut, but is in the brain, it doesn't matter. It's going to force it back into its prior gut microbiome pattern. So you've got to go back to the source of what the problem is. If the source is, in fact, the gut, we have taken people who have had Crohn's disease. We've sterilized their guts. We've given them fecal transplant. Now, sterilization of the gut's not an easy thing to do. Typically takes about 2 years. There's a doc I've worked with in Australia who believes that the Crohn's is specifically secondary to a Mycoplasma avium infection. Killing that, it's a slow-growing bug. It can take 2 years of antibiotics. Ain't a fun process. But we've also then transplanted gut microbiomes from fecal transplants into these individuals, and they're in remission. So I am not a specialist in Crohn's disease. That's not what I do. I'm a neuroinflammatory guy. And I want to back up also and talk about celiac for 1 second, because celiac doesn't necessarily present as gut problems.
Yeah, anxiety. Mood. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, 5% is going to present only as neurologic issues. Okay? So I had a kid who was 17 years old, severely depressed, non-responsive to treatment, tried to hang himself, and they sent him to me because I'm a neuroinflammatory guy. And I worked him up and diagnosed him with celiac disease. He had no gastrointestinal complaints, none. He had celiac disease. We got him off all gluten. We healed the gut. Within a year's time, he's off all antidepressants. The depression is gone. I followed him now for 6 years or so. He's been 100%.
I have a simple question. So there's some discussion around best ways to test for this, right? The gold standard is colonoscopy, apparently, right?
Endoscopy.
If they've been on gluten. Any thoughts on blood testing, screening tools? What do you do first before you do such an invasive procedure, so to speak?
I think the blood testing is perfectly adequate. I think the Europeans demonstrated this, demonstrating transglutaminase levels. I don't see any reason to do anything past that. Now, the caveat—
What if they've been off gluten?
There's the caveat. Caveat is if you've been off gluten for 3 months, basically things should have healed. So now what we would look at in endoscopy, we would see changes in the villi, these little outpouchings in the gut that help absorb things. So we would see loss of the blunting of the villi, and we would see an abundance of inflammatory cells. 3 months later, all that should repair and the antibodies should clear. So if you've been off gluten for 3 months and the test comes back negative, it doesn't mean necessarily that you don't have celiac disease. And so that can be a caveat. And sometimes what we'll do is we'll challenge for 2 weeks with gluten and then test, and that should work. Now, that's about 1% of the population. About 16% of the population has gluten sensitivity.
Yeah.
So it's not a true autoimmune disease, but really what it is, and what I believe it is a toxicity to glyphosates, herbicides. So we use these things called GMOs, and these are seeds which are manufactured to be resistant to the herbicides. Mm-hmm. They're genetically modified. So then we pour all of this glyphosates onto the plants in order to increase the yield. The plant then takes up the herbicide, stores it, but it doesn't affect it because the plants have been genetically engineered to not be impacted by it, except that herbicide moves from the plant through processing into your Cheerios, and you get to then eat them.
I want to talk to you about this, because this topic bothers me a lot because of reasons. So go
should bother
going.
All of us.
Well, it bothers me because it's not good. And that's not a good enough explanation to me, because we're putting glyphosate on all kinds of things. And so actually, there's not Roundup Ready wheat. There's genetically engineered wheat, but there's not Roundup Ready wheat. So the only reason that they should be putting Roundup on wheat is if it's not drying down for harvest, then they would be spraying it on to kill it, which... I live in the middle of wheat country. So this that's why it bugs me, because I'm like, well, that theory isn't good enough because they're actually not really ever doing that. That would be really uncommon depending on weather patterns. It might be more common in other areas that grow wheat. Here in this whole area, it's not common at all because it dries down. So I agree. Like, I think there's for sure a toxicity thing. I'm just like, there must be more as well. And there must be also processing as well, because we have genetically modified fruits, right, for the same purposes. And we are... corn and soybeans are probably the most heavily doused in glyphosate. So why is it wheat, right? So actually, this is like a long, we're probably not going to answer this question.
It's an extremely important question. But what I will note is that I have patients who cannot tolerate gluten in any way, shape, or form unless they go to Europe.
Oh, I see this all the time.
Right.
I have been turning this over as to why this is for a long time. I mean, I'm like, I feel like the only answer is for me to go shadow some wheat farmers in Europe for a while and try to understand. I think there is varieties, probably. I just am like, why aren't we sensitive to more than just wheat if it's glyphosate? Because glyphosate wouldn't be enough of an answer for me on this particular topic, just because I'm intimately familiar with the industry. So it's a weird, I understand it's a very commonly discussed thing in functional and integrated medicine. It's just not good enough for me yet. And so I'm like, oh, probably better
fair
go
enough.
To Europe.
Dig deeper.
Yeah, exactly. Dig for all deeper. Of us. And I totally respect it. It's like, yeah, what else is, there's got to be more that's like massively affecting the neuroinflammatory. A more applicable question also that I want to ask you is, you mentioned 16% is gluten sensitive. People ask me all the time, you know, I'm pretty, like I am a rational person who likes birthday cake. And so some people are all like, no gluten for anybody. And then some people are like, I am. It depends on if you react to it, right? And what the problems are, right? Like, not everything is, we don't have to, if it causes more stress for you to avoid it and you're not having symptoms, I don't really see the point of this. So I'm just curious about your opinion, because I think as people hear this, they're like, oh, maybe I should just avoid gluten altogether. Well, does it cause a problem for you? That would be my perspective. I'd love to hear your perspective.
So pretty much the same as yours. I mean, basically what we do is we take people off this stuff. Rice, fish, chicken, fresh fruits and vegetables. No soy, no corn, no gluten. Mm-hmm. All right. 1 month.
Makes sense.
Then we start adding foods back in, assuming you've noticed any difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We start adding foods back in one group at a time, and we give it a week or two, and we see if you react to it. Because what happens is when you're allergic to things or sensitive to things, you keep eating them, you're kind of in the soup and you get this low grade muck.
Yeah.
So when we step out of that, and then it's about as we identify things that don't cause you to feel good, bloating, gas, a little more fatigue, a little less focus. Now you can attend to these things because we've cleaned things up, and then we can add the stuff back in, and then you need to make your choices. You need to figure out what makes sense for you. Celiac is a true autoimmune disease. No discussion. You have to be off gluten because you're killing yourself.
Yep.
Gluten sensitivity, you'll aggravate yourself. And how much of that do you want to do? And, you know, we want people to be responsible for themselves. So, yeah, you judge what you're doing. To your point, though, about you're right about the wheat, that what we do is we don't typically spray it on the crop, but we spray it on it after harvest for harvest drying.
Kill it to dry it down. Yeah,
to dry it out. But it still takes it up and it still carries it through the process.
Yeah, it's just not a common practice. So it's, I'm like, there must be more.
Well, there's also,
I agree with you.
The GMOs also have a higher concentration of gluten in them.
Right.
Than the non-GMOs.
That's true. Because they make more money when the protein is higher when they sell it. So, and it might not just be, you know, there's other proteins as well. But yes, absolutely. That one but I
we'll build antibody reactions to proteins.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So like this could be 3 or 4 episodes. So I'm going to keep us scooching along simply because I want to get to all of the good Gary Kaplan material. So you treat a ton of people with hard stuff. I'm actually kind of curious why you got into pain in the first place. And when I first read your stuff and you're doing chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic pain, post-Lyme, chronic non-responsive depression, I was like, man, this guy is a glutton for punishment, or he just loves to achieve and they just started sending him. So I'm curious about that. And then let's get into, you mentioned this offline, these are not separate conditions. So maybe if you want, talk a little bit about how you ended up getting all these people, but let's talk about why these are not separate conditions.
So they're not separate conditions because it turns out they're all neuroinflammatory conditions. They have different ways of presenting in different people because our genes are different, because our backgrounds and experiences are different. But the reality of the matter is they're all inflammation of the brain. Now, we've talked about the innate side of things. Mm-hmm. The other thing we have to talk about is the acquired. And that's been the area that I've been most focused on in the last several years, because the acquired is you get an immunization and you develop antibodies, right? Mm-hmm. So you get an immunization against flu, you develop antibodies to the flu so that when the flu bug shows up, your immune system's ready to roll and take it on and hopefully fight it off before you even get sick, or at least cause a much less severe reaction to the bug. Those are antibodies. Well, it turns out that things get a bit fouled up sometimes. So in things like Lyme disease, and Lyme disease is the whole tick-borne disease stuff, right? So it's not just Lyme, it's Bartonella, it's Plasma Ehrlichia, Babesia. There's a whole bunch of different bugs that takes care of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. But what happens in those infections, in about 20% of people, so 80% of people get the bug, get treated, get better, they're done, which is the same thing that we see in COVID, which is the same thing that we see in strep. So this is not unique to one set of diseases per se. It's in fact, almost most viruses and bacteria can create this problem. And so what that happens is the immune system ramps up and goes after the bug. Mm-hmm. It's what it's supposed to do. It makes antibodies to go kill that specific bug. And antibodies are specific. They are specific for flu. The antibodies you make to flu will not kill Lyme disease. They will not kill strep. So you need different sets of antibodies in order to respond to this stuff. But if the reaction is screwed up because the immune system's weakened for some reason or has been damaged or the response is excessive, what happens is the immune system looks around and goes, you know what? The protein on that bug looks really similar to your brain. And then it starts attacking your brain. And now your brain's inflamed. So now what happens? Focus, concentration issues, difficulty falling asleep, depression, anxiety disorders, chronic pain. Generalized pain in particular. All of these are a result of the brain becoming inflamed, but where's the trigger? In the case of an infection, you had an overreaction of the acquired immune system, which is now building antibodies to the brain itself. So treatment requires killing the bug, but it also requires treating the immune system on the acquired side as well as the innate side in order to get that quieted down. Okay. Treating the acquired side of the immune system is a bit more complicated and not something you can really do on your own.
Okay. I want to make sure we understand. So we talked about innate. We talked about it being in the gut. We talked about microglial activation. Now we're talking about this acquired immune system. I want to hear you so far mentioned that vaccinations inform the acquired immune system, and I would assume mm-hmm. environment. What's informing the acquired immune system before we talk about treating?
Well, the acquired immune system, you get a bug. You get an mm-hmm. infection. Okay. Mm-hmm. The body has an initial response to it, but then it wants to keep a memory of this stuff. And it wants to know, in case this shows up again, I can fight
smart,
it.
Smart brain. Body.
Yeah. So that's what the antibodies do. You make the antibodies. Now, the antibodies don't last forever. As we talked about in celiac disease, after 3 months, they clear. In the case of flu, you have to get a flu shot every year because the antibodies only last about 6 months and then they clear. Some are long-term, measles, mumps, rubella, will stay with us pretty much throughout life.
Why is that?
Don't know.
It's kind of bizarre, right? Why would measles mumps and rubella stay absolutely,
and I would have to talk with my immunology friends to get a better explanation of that. But I haven't heard a good explanation, even though I've asked that question a few times. But there are some just maintain the memory. Others do not. And so COVID, you know, the reason we've gotten all these immunizations is because the immunizations don't last. I mean, the immunizations are good for about 3 to 6 months max. And thus, we have to keep coming up, and the virus itself is evolving, and we have to keep coming up with new formulas in order to treat it. But COVID in particular is a nasty bug because about 25% of people who get COVID develop long COVID. That's a serious problem.
Yeah, let's talk about what is long COVID, first of all.
Long COVID is you get sick and you stay sick. And long COVID can look like a lot of different things. So chronic fatigue can certainly be one of the presentations and the most common presentation, like chronic headaches, digestive issues, heart issues. COVID does affect the heart in a high percentage of people. And so you can end up with congestive heart failure, cardiomyopathy, which is an inflammation of the heart muscle. You can end up with asthma. And you also end up with a thing that very interesting, shortness of breath, where the lungs themselves test out fine, but you get short of breath. And I had the distinct unpleasure of having that happen to me after I had an episode of COVID for about a month. Fortunately, it went away. We define long COVID also as symptoms which persist, depends who you chat with, anywhere from a month past your infection or to 3 months. Mm-hmm. And it can be fairly disabling. And it varies everywhere from annoying to disabling and extremely disabling, where people are bedbound and really have to leave their jobs. And, you know, there's massive consequences to this economically, but there's also massive consequences to this psychologically. Their participation in their families get diminished dramatically. It really is a problem. And they become increasingly socially isolated, which social isolation, by the way, turns out to be one of the largest killers in the United States. Social isolation is the equivalent. It's more health benefits are worse than smoking 16 cigarettes a day or having 6 drinks a day of alcohol.
This is literally what my conclusion was after visiting Europe for 2.5 weeks, was that everyone's like, man, I feel better when I'm in Europe. And I'm like, yes, the food is somewhat different. We're on a bit of a Mediterranean diet here in Spain. But you guys are not sleeping. You're drinking all the time. And a lot of you are smoking. But you are so darn social and you just dance your life off and you eat for 2 hours. So you're definitely digesting your food. That was all I could come up with so far.
And the Surgeon General issued a report this year talking about the severity of the problem of loneliness and social isolation. So that creating these networks. And when you get this sick, you end up isolating. Mm-hmm. You end up not seeing your friends. You end up not, you know, the kids I see. Okay, definition of a kid. All right, I've been at this for a while. Definition of a kid in my practice is anybody younger than my oldest daughter. Mm-hmm. My oldest daughter is 39. Mm-hmm. So increasingly, I'm running a pediatric practice.
Yeah.
But the reality of the matter is this impacts people across all age groups. Mm-hmm. And it seems to disproportionately impact people, teens and 20s and 30s. And that's a large portion of my practice. So we do see people certainly in their 50s, 60s, and older. So the reality is these are diseases impacting all of us. COVID is something which is going to be with us for the rest of our lives, probably. It's endemic now. So meaning that it is just part of the background viruses that we have to deal with year in and year out. It looks like the newer viruses may create long COVID less than the earlier viruses did. So Delta, hands down, was among the worst. But, and what we talked about earlier, by the way, in terms of the immune system, people die from COVID, not from the bug itself, but from the immune system's reaction to that bug.
Yeah. So what was the stress on the immune system before they got it? Would that be correct, right?
That would be absolutely correct. And so that then backs us up to a conversation you and I started to have about epigenetics. And epigenetics are the things that turn on and off our genes. And those things are environmental. So we talked about the potential impact of adverse events of childhood, but we also are exposed to toxins. We're exposed to heavy metals. Where? Well, in tuna fish, mercury, and in other fish, mercury, unfortunately. In the dental amalgams that we no longer use, those will kick out mercury on a regular basis.
But we have. People have.
They do have. If you got 3 or more of those, you might want to look into them. If lead is unfortunately far too prevalent in our water supply. But it was also prevalent in a lot of paint we used on older buildings. And in fact, a couple of years ago in New Orleans, they were, after flood damage and hurricane damage, they were power washing and sanding down these old mansions, which had been painted with lead paint, and they aerosolized all the lead. So it went into the air, everybody's breathing it, and lo and behold, the number of lead toxicity cases is going way up. We tend to focus on kids with lead toxicity because it does a lot of damage to the brain. Yeah. But in adults, it can cause hypertension. And in fact, one of the things that correlated with a decrease in heart disease is switching from leaded to unleaded gasoline.
Oh, interesting.
But environmental pollutions, air pollution, we know definitely has a long-term impact. You're in a better place for that than I am.
Yeah,
meaning that you have very little of it compared to what I have to deal with. Mm-hmm. So we need to be attentive to these things. Mold toxins. If you're living in a water-damaged building, you probably are getting exposed to mold. Again, not everybody's going to have a problem with it because genetically you process the toxins. But in a lot of the large percentage of people, again, it comes out about 20%. They don't have the enzymes necessary to process the mold toxins. They accumulate in your body. Where do they accumulate? Well, one of the places is the brain. Another place is in the wall of the gut because they're all fat soluble. Can also be in the lungs and create asthma problems. So if you got a symptom, right? I bang my thumb with a hammer. My thumb hurts. Okay. I think I know what happened there. But when you're finding that your focus and concentration isn't what it used to be, your memory, you're missing things, you're having problems with energy. It's just, you're just not as well rested as you used to be. You can't exercise to the extent that you used to. You're having more aches and pains generalized. Okay. Mood, a little anxious, a little depression. And now you've got some more generalized stuff going on. Digestion isn't working the way it should. Now you got to step back and you got to say, okay, this is a picture of somebody who's inflamed. And this is a picture of what we want to do in order to quiet things down. So we start thinking in terms of where's the inflammation? Is it in the gut? Is it in the brain? And then what's causing the inflammation? So we have the things that set you up, all these epigenetic things we just talked about, and those have to be treated. If you're mold toxic, we got to get that out. If you're heavy metal toxic, we got to get that out of you. And in fact, I just saw a patient yesterday, dramatically elevated mercury levels. Why? Well, he eats a lot of sushi. And in fact, the solution for him is simply take him off the sushi.
How did you test him for mercury? Because you could test urine, which is more acute.
We do blood testing.
Blood testing.
We do blood testing for through labs that specialize in doing heavy metals. And hair is also potential, but the trick with hair is there's a lot of environmental pollutions. And yeah, it's long term.
Yeah.
You won't necessarily pick it up as acutely. So then we use hair products that can, and dyes, and all this stuff, which can cloud the whole picture. So the blood testing is what we rely on. So we're looking at what are the things that potentially set up the immune system. And I want to get back to one second, this business about adverse events of childhood, okay? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is so important and not addressed. We think of, oh, it's a psychiatric problem. Oh, it's a neurologic problem, okay? We have to stop thinking like that, all right? I'll give you an example of a kid that I saw yesterday. Beautiful young woman. She's currently around 15, 16 years old. For the last 3 years, since she got COVID, anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, eating disorder, she has been going into rage attacks. She's had to be taken. They've had to call the police on her multiple times because she's become so violent. They've taken her down for a psychiatric admission, and she's been evaluated by one of the leading children's hospitals in the country, and they simply said, oh, it's all behavioral, right? This kid was not like this 3 years ago. All of a sudden, she gets COVID and bang, now we've got a kid who's a massive problem. And we're throwing lots of psychiatric meds at her and no one's willing to step back and say, wait a minute, is there something else here? She is post-COVID. She has PANS, pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric syndrome, horribly named, but nevertheless, Sueno did a huge favor to us in the process of creating that classification. And what we're now seeing is a kid that has post-COVID. Now we have to treat her. We have to look and see whether she's developed antibodies or she stayed on the innate side. Now, there's a huge discussion going on in the field as to whether or not we're looking at a problem on the innate or the acquired side. We think a large portion of these are associated with damage to a particular type of white cell that stays in the system. The spike protein probably did the damage and keeps this thing going. So the important thing is there is no active COVID in your body. Okay. You're not infectious. You are not able to spread the disease. But your immune system's been turned on because a piece of the bug is still there. And so you create these kind of zombie cells, which don't die because cells are supposed to go through a normal life cycle, but keep spewing out lots of inflammatory factors. These things are referred to as cytokines. So we can measure the cytokines, and then there are specific things we can do to treat it. This gets back to our earlier discussion about you have to know what's causing the inflammation because that guides you as to what you should be targeting. So low-dose naltrexone has been shown to be effective in a number of these people. using metformin. Mm-hmm. Metformin is a drug that we typically use for treating diabetes, but metformin also modulates the functioning of the acquired immune system. And so metformin has been shown to be effective in some studies. And more recently, the suggestion is that we should be giving metformin anytime somebody gets acute COVID, because it will prevent the occurrence of long COVID.
Can I ask a question about this?
Sure.
Okay, so we have natural metformin, inositol, mm-hmm. somewhat classified mm-hmm. as a B vitamin. Do we feel like this could work, or we just haven't really tested it yet?
Haven't just tested curious. It. Don't yep, know.
Just curious.
Yeah, okay. It might.
I'm so on the edge of my seat about this 16-year-old girl that's lost her life, honestly, yeah. as she knows it, post-COVID. And so the treatment pie, I'm listening earnestly to hear how you're going to address this. And so far, it's like you could do some low-dose LDN, maybe some metformin, carry on.
So we've got more questions, Seth. So I need labs back on her now mm-hmm. to assess what's going on in the immune system and assess whether or not there's anything else sitting there. Are there mold
yeah.
toxins?
Did the COVID just activate some other mess that was there? And now, and so there's like multiple pieces to treat. Because it feels like when we're talking about long COVID, it's like there was already crap going on. There was already immune junk happening. And so now the bucket's just like overflowing and now we're in desperation. And unfortunately, sometimes when we're in that bad of a place, I think this is where the LDN is probably amazing, right? Because you get immediate change. Because from my perspective, which that's not in my toolbox, it's kind of harder once they're already at that point. You've got to, because I've still got to go back and do all the stuff that was a mess probably before, right? But when they're in this desperation place, they might not even be able to do some of those interventions. So this is where my brain is like on the struggle bus over here. So
in fact, she was put on a low-dose naltrexone just before I saw her, and it mm-hmm. dramatically improved her, stabilized. Good. Long way from cured, but it certainly made a big difference for her. But there are other medications we use called Maraviroc. Maraviroc is a drug that was developed for treatment of HIV/AIDS. Maraviroc helps interfere with a specific type of receptor in the non-classical monocytes. I'm getting way into the weeds here. But basically, that will help turn off the production of the inflammatory particles coming out of the monocyte, the white cell. Pravastatin, which is a statin, actually can help reduce the inflammatory process as well. Baby aspirin can also help modulate that if the what's called the SCDL-40 is particularly elevated, because that's a cytokine that comes out of platelets. So those are things we can do. But NAC and acetylcysteine can actually be effective in reducing the response and shutting it off. Lumbarkinase, nanokinase, can also be effective in terms of complement reducing this. These are things that are available over the counter, as can bromelain. So early studies on this stuff suggesting that these may be effective. Cost-benefit ratio kind of goes, try it, why not? Mm-hmm, and sure. So these things can all be helpful in terms of doing this. But you're also absolutely correct. We got to back up. Is there mold toxicity? Are there other toxins in this kid's system? What's the gut look like? In order to fully comprehend how the system broke and what we need to do to repair it.
I've been over here thinking that long COVID and people really struggling with post-COVID had a lot of mitochondrial dysfunction before they arrived at that area. And maybe there's just, I think we can just say there's overlap there probably, but mm-hmm. you're coming at it from a standpoint of, well, the immune system was already weak. Why was the immune system already weak? First of all, we got to put out the fire. I mean, what I'm hearing is there is a hell of a fire going on. How do we put out the fire so we can actually go figure out the root cause of the fire, essentially? Right.
And in all of these chronic diseases, mitochondrial dysfunction is part and parcel of the issue. And you have to be addressing that. You can address that with probably the most effective way. And we do that sometimes with IV, but oral NAD can be effective. And so you've got to be doing mitochondrial repair as part of what you're doing. Again, it's a comprehensive process. There's no here, take this and you're all fixed when you've been that sick for that long. And then in a number of these people, there's a subgroup of people with long COVID who have an autoimmune process. And then what we have to do is identify where that autoimmune process is and treat that. That's more complicated. Then we need to do intravenous immunoglobulins. We may need to do a thing called plasma. We're looking into some processes where we can use stem cells. That's all experimental at this point in time, but, or use T cell regulators. Again, that's more on the experimental end of things. So there's potentially a lot involved. Unfortunately, 75% of people get better on their own. So we're good.
Yeah. I have lots of notes here. I feel like a second episode is coming on. One thing that was kind of at the beginning of my notes as I was observing, you're in private practice, but you're also teaching. So something that's really cool for the rest of us is it sounds like you are teaching what you are learning. Tell me how your practice impacts your teaching.
Oh, I mean, my patients are my greatest teachers. I'm learning from them all the time. There's nothing like clinical practice to keep you humble, right?
Yeah, every time you think
you know something, somebody shows up at your door. And you asked how I ended up with these really complex patients. It's the curse of being successful.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
So as you're successful with the easy ones, they say, oh, here, try this one.
Yeah, exactly.
And the next thing you know, you're kind of going, wow. And that keeps you in the books and that keeps you studying and trying to find better ways to help these individuals. So one of the things we're also doing, so the book is a guideline for people, kind of a do-it-yourself, to inform yourself about all of these different things. It lays out all the testing we do. It's not the be-all and end test of testing in the labs that we use, but it's a place to start. Mm-hmm. You can have a conversation with your doctor on the basis of having read this book, oh, what about this? What about this? And make sure you're getting the right test done. Because the other challenge is if you don't do the right test, you don't get the right answer, right? So if I check your blood count and I check for coagulation factors, but I don't bother to check your blood sugar and you have diabetes, well, I'll miss the diagnosis.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got to ask the right tests. And unfortunately, almost all the people I see have quote-unquote normal labs. And they have normal labs because the right testing was not done.
Right. They did like $6 of testing.
Right. So that has to be changed. The other thing is we've got a conference coming up November 8, 9, 10. It'll be here in DC, but it can be attended virtually. We want both the public as well as clinicians and researchers attending this program. This is new developments in understanding chronic illness. We have assembled an all-star faculty. We have people from NIH and Stanford and Georgetown and Cornell. And so what we want to do is bring this diverse group of diseases under one roof so that we're talking about the commonalities here and common solutions here. So we're bringing some of our best and brightest into one room who don't normally talk to each other. We have pediatricians and we have rheumatologists and we have a neurologist and family physicians. And so this is a diverse group of docs and researchers who aren't necessarily looking at other people's research across the board. We have specialists in post-COVID syndrome. We have testing. We talk about different testing and treatment modalities. The conference is a medical conference. It's got CME for docs and continuing medical education for physicians. But I think the public can benefit from hearing this and gaining a lot more knowledge of what's going on. We did this last year. We had over 900 people at the conference. And it's a great way to get educated about what's going on and what's happening. For the public, we ask that they just be online because we're having docs live and it changes the room, if you will.
Yep.
And I need docs to be able to talk to docs and start creating community and research ideas and opportunities for collaboration.
What's this conference called?
New Developments in Understanding Chronic Illness.
Oh, there it was.
The role of immune dysfunction and infections.
Cool. Is it on your website?
It is on the foundation website. So foundationfortotalrecovery.org. And so if you go to that website, it'll show you what the foundation's doing. But the foundation is an education and research foundation. It's a 501(c) that I created after my first book for the purposes of doing education and research in this field. This will be our third conference. And we also had speakers from Oxford. It was exceptionally well received last year. We had people from Israel and Brazil and Australia. And so we're excited about this program. We're excited about the opportunity to educate our colleagues. And we're excited to be able to educate the public so that they can get better answers. And so this conference, November 8, 9, 10, will be here in DC. And I hope your listeners will sign up and attend.
We'll get this rearranged so this comes out before that. I don't know. How do you have enough time in the day for all this, Dr. Kaplan?
Not getting as much sleep as I tell everybody else to.
Yes, embodiment is the real challenge, isn't it?
And I have an incredibly understanding wife. And so the kids are launched. So that makes my life a little bit easier. But it's my passion. I love what I do. I'm privileged to be able to do it.
You're making a big difference.
Opportunity. Trying.
Yeah, you're making a big difference. I hope that you'll agree for part two of this because we didn't get to all the things. And I think there's a lot here. Either before or after the conference, tell us the name of the book again and your other website where people can find you.
So Why You Are Still Sick, How Infections Break Our Immune System. So that's available on Amazon, easy to get a hold of. The center is the Kaplan Center for Integrative Medicine, also kaplanclinic.com, K-A-P-L-A-N, clinic.com. And a lot of information we've put on our website, a lot of lectures that we've done. Our center is three physicians and nurse practitioner, an acupuncturist, herbalist, nutritionist, a psychotherapist, and So we've got a big, and physical therapists. So we have a big team to address these complicated problems.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It was a blast. I've got a great list for next time. And good luck with this conference. And I'm also checking it out myself.
Krista, thank you. It's a privilege being here. And thank you for the work you're doing in terms of getting the word out to educate patients and help them have better lives.
Yeah, thank you.
Sharing and reviewing this podcast is the best way to help us succeed with our mission to help integrate the best of East and West and empower you to raise the bar on your health story. Just go to reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. That's reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. And you'll be taken directly to a page where you can insert your review and hit post.